26, another two will be in October. The vice presidential contenders, who have yet to be announced, are expected to face off October 2nd in St. Louis. The NFL Players Association says executive director Gene Upshaw has died. The Hall of Fame guard died last night at his home in California after battling pancreatic cancer. He was 63 years old. NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell says that as union head for the last 25 years, Upshaw fought hard for NFL players and was crucial in taking pro football to new heights. Before that, Upshaw played with the Oakland Raiders for 15 seasons, and during that time, the team won two Super Bowls. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from sitforless.com, online seller of the Herman Miller Aeron chair. All Aeron colors and configurations available on the web at sitforless.com.
Support for today's broadcast comes from World Gourmet Foods, now in their new location at 105 Krispy Kreme Drive in Bloomington, serving the area with gourmet foods from around the world. Their grand opening will be held on Saturday, September 13th, with a large food show featuring more than 500 samples. Information at worldgourmetfoods.com. Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Kraner Center for the Performing Arts, inviting the community to experience the opening wave of the 2008-2009 season, featuring Anne-Sophie Mutter, the Builders Association, Bang on a Can All-Stars, the Sphinx Chamber Orchestra, and Eastern Bloc. More information is available at KranerCenter.com.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our number two of the program. It's our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Freinas at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the Great Lakes and about the effort of people around the Great Lakes to preserve and protect this great natural resource. The Great Lakes hold 95% of the available surface freshwater in the United States. It's 18% of the world's available surface freshwater. And for the Great Lakes, this is a very important resource. It supports a year-round sport fishery. It provides a route for commercial and recreational navigation. And many communities around the lakes depend on them for their drinking water. So it is important in terms of the economy. It's important in terms of satisfying a basic need. And there are concerns about whether or not this resource not only can be protected, but can indeed be preserved, and whether or not there are people in other parts of the country, maybe even other parts of the world, that have designs on that water. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about these issues with Dave Dempsey. He is Communications Director for Conservation Minnesota. That is a nonprofit organization based in Minneapolis. He lives in St. Paul himself. He also serves on the board of directors of the Alliance for the Great Lakes and is well known for writing about environmental issues in the Great Lakes region. He is the author of the book Great Lakes for Sale, From White Caps to Bottle Caps. The book is out now, if you're interested, published by Caravan. That's the University of Michigan Press, Ann Arbor. And questions are certainly welcome if you'd like to join in the conversation here. We ask only of people who call in, just that people keep their questions and comments brief so we can keep moving along. But anybody's certainly welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also get have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call for you, you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana or across the country on the Internet, and you can use the toll-free line. The call's on us, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. So at any point, questions are certainly welcome. Mr. Dempsey, hello.
Good morning. How are you, David?
I'm fine. Thanks, and yourself?
Just great.
Thanks for talking with us.
Sure.
We can talk about a number of things here, and particularly get some kind of historical perspective on, particularly on the issue of diversion of the waters from the lakes. I guess as a general question, and we'll also talk about what's happening in terms of legislation with this. But right at the moment, are the Great Lakes in danger?
Well, it depends on your perspective. Right now, at this moment, to be really precise, the Great Lakes are actually rebounding from low water levels. But in terms of their future prospects, yes, I think they are in danger. They're in danger from a growing population in the U.S. that has limited access to adequate fresh water in the Southwest, and I think it's also at risk, the Great Lakes are also at risk from commercialization of water by the packaged water industry.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about now that what has happened here over the last few years, and certainly going back a few years, the governments of the Canadian provinces and of the states and the cities surrounding the lakes that really depend on them for a variety of things, as we mentioned, decided that really they had to get together to be organized to try to protect the resource. And so they did that, and now we have legislation that's making its way through the Congress. I believe, if I got this right, it has actually passed the Senate.
Correct.
And is waiting for some action in the House. Now, I guess they're not there right at the moment. Let's talk a little bit about this legislation and what it would do, and then we can talk about when it might make the rest of the trip through the Congress.
Sure. Well, in the book, I go back 25 years, but the most current legislation really reaches back about 10 years. 10 years ago, there was a furor in the Great Lakes region because a company in Ontario got permission from the province to take the equivalent of 50 ships or tankers of water out of Lake Superior every year and send it to Asia for commercial customers. That enraged people in the region, and the governors and premiers decided at that point to start negotiating an agreement that would limit the opportunity for Great Lakes exports. In 2001, then, they signed a statement of principles that kind of outlined what the agreement would look like. And in 2005, the eight Great Lakes states actually put forth for state ratification an interstate compact that is supposed to limit water exports. That compact was ratified by the legislatures of each of the Great Lakes states, including Illinois, in the last couple of years, and is off to Congress for congressional consent. And as you said, passed the Senate very quickly earlier this summer, and is poised for approval by the U.S. House this fall, probably.
And I think that according to what I have read, that the president has said if the Congress passes this, that he will sign it.
He said he supports it. That's for sure. Yes.
Yeah. There, I guess, though, in some people's minds, some questions remain about whether this indeed is going to protect the resource. And particularly, one of the things that I think concerns people has to do with people who might want to bottle the water, because it, maybe what this says is that you can't load a big tanker up with water and ship it out. But if you want to load a tanker full of small bottles of water, that's something else. Is there still concern about the commercialization and of the commercial exploitation in that kind of way of the resource?
Well, it's certainly my concern, and I guess the concern of a small number of Great Lakes advocates, although I'd have to say the environmental community generally in the basin, Great Lakes Basin, is very supportive of the compact and thinks it should go ahead. The compact is clear in making it very difficult, if not impossible, to build an aqueduct to take water from, say, Lake Michigan to Texas, but the same water can leave in bottles in the same amounts and go to Texas under the terms of the compact. And I think the issue is even bigger than that. The compact defines water as a product once it's put into a container. So we're essentially saying that that kind of use of Great Lakes water, that kind of capture and sale, is not going to be covered by the ban on exports.
Well, and is this something that, as you said, that environmentalists generally are behind the legislation that we've talked about? You're on the board of directors of the Alliance for the Great Lakes, and I think the Alliance has officially said, yes, we think this is a good thing. Are environmental groups, do they just think that this is, at this point, the best they can do, or this is a good first step?
Well, I'm glad you pointed out the Alliance for the Great Lakes position, because since you mentioned I'm on the board, I don't want it to be construed that I'm speaking for that organization.
Oh, sure. Sure,
so
sure.
They are definitely supporting the compact, and I have questions about it. But I think the reasons for support in the environmental community for the compact range from, yes, it's the best we can do right now, and we can come back later and worry about commercialization, to, frankly, a belief that this compact really doesn't open it up to commercialization. It's a strong difference of opinion.
Mm. Well, and I think that this is interesting because when people think about diversion and their concerns about diversion, I'm sure that what they think of is the very thing that you mentioned, is that somebody's going to come along and build a pipeline and take the water from the lakes and pipe it to Texas or to Arizona or California or something like that, where there still are concerns about diversion. One that we've talked about, the idea of taking the water and bottling it, but there still remain concerns about who gets access to the water, who uses it, and where you're going to draw the line that says, past this, on one side of this line, it's okay for you to use the water, and on the other side of the line, it's not. And particularly, I think, for communities that are just on the line who are in the states and around the Midwest, who are just kind of on that line. I'm sure that there are people who are, they're looking over the line at the people on the other side that get to use the water, and they say that, well, why can't we also have access to some of that water?
That's right. The compact does provide some flexibility for some of those communities. If you're in a straddling county, which basically means a county that is partly in and partly out of the Great Lakes watershed, you can, under some very strict standards, get access to Great Lakes water. I'm not totally comfortable with that either, but it does allow for some of these sprawling communities, say Waukesha, Wisconsin, to get access if they do certain conservation techniques.
Well, even for the communities in the states that are in the watershed and have gotten together to try to work out some kind of deal about how they're going to use that resource, have they really done a good job at that?
In terms of the compact or prior to the compact?
Well, I guess I think of it in terms of the compact and after.
Well, in that sense, I think the compact is a step forward. It at least puts all the states on record in a legal document that theoretically is enforceable by any of us in the court of law if we can afford to sue. Puts on record conservation principles and review standards for new withdrawals of water that are way beyond what most of the states, or at least some of the states, have ever done before. I'm from Michigan originally, and until 2006, there were absolutely no statutory limits on how much water you could remove from Michigan waters. It was all subject to common law, basically meaning lawsuits. So Michigan has, in some ways, the farthest to go and is at least beginning to make that march in the compact.
Well, I think this points to something that's really significant, and we've here on the program have occasionally had some conversations about water issues of water use here in our area, and that it all comes down to there is this principle that says, if you have land and it's on top of an aquifer, you're entitled to drill a well and draw water, and I guess the same thing counts if you have land and there a stream flows by. You're entitled to take water out of that, and then it comes down to individuals having to kind of duke it out with each other about what's acceptable water use. And I suppose then the court of last resort is in fact the court, and it may indeed be up to some judge to decide whether an individual is drawing more water than they're really entitled to, and to work those kinds of things out. It seems that we really don't have a very good mechanism for getting people together who draw on a common resource, whether that's a lake in this case, or whether here where we live it's an aquifer, to get everybody to sort of sit down and say, look, this is a common resource. We all depend on this. We need to figure out some way that we can draw on this sustainably and actually do it in a kind of a civil, reasonable kind of way.
Yes, and I think in a sense the compact is helping make the transition from the old sort of Wild West approach where you drill a well or take water out of a stream and if somebody objects they take you to court to a more rational system where you try to figure out how much water can be withdrawn without damaging the system and figure out ways to allow for the use. And really what's happening is that the Great Lakes, as you said, 18% of the world's available freshwater are becoming more and more tempting to people from far away regions and countries, and so to assure that we can manage the Great Lakes for our own demands, we're going to have to conserve to be able to prevent these raids from other areas.
Well, that are you still going to have a difficult time making this argument that says there are some people who are going to make the argument that says that the Great Lakes don't just belong to the people of the Midwest, that they belong to the people of the United States and Canada, and that the people of the Midwest shouldn't be able to say this is ours, and if you really need it badly, that's too bad because it's ours, and we're not going to let you put a pipeline to Texas, or we're not going to let you fill up your tanker and take it someplace else. I mean, how do you deal with that kind of argument that says this is not just a resource that belongs to the people of the Midwest, but it's a resource that belongs to the people of the of North America?
Well, I have two responses to that, and part of me in the first response feels this resource doesn't just belong to the people of the Great Lakes, but it belongs to humanity. And if there is a worldwide crisis or a crisis in a particular part of the world, we might need to think about temporarily sharing Great Lakes water to save lives. The compact really doesn't address that in any detail. It does allow for exemptions to the ban on long-range transfer water if for, quote, humanitarian emergencies or purposes, and it doesn't really define that. So I think that's where more thought needs to be given. If I were a philanthropist, I'd probably start funding some effort to figure out under what circumstances and for how long would we try to or authorize the sharing of water to save lives anywhere in the world. As far as the issue of basically hoarding, which is sort of what it comes down to, are we hoarding the water by passing a compact and saying nobody else can take it? I don't think so, because we're not saying people can't use the water. We're basically saying if they want to use the water, they need to move to the Great Lakes region where it's found and not ship it far away. So the use isn't the question. It's just are you going to live in the watershed and return a lot of that water to the Great Lakes, or are you going to try to take it away and not return a lot of it if you're in Texas or Arizona?
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dave Dempsey. He's Communications Director for Conservation Minnesota. That is a nonprofit organization based in Minneapolis. He also serves on the board of directors of the Alliance for the Great Lakes and is well known for writing on environmental issues in the Great Lakes region. He makes his own home in St. Paul and is author of the book Great Lakes for Sale from White Caps to Bottle Caps, which takes a look at this issue we're here talking about, published by the University of Michigan Press. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Talked a little bit earlier about maybe the precipitating event that got the provinces and the states to start talking and form the compact in the first place was somebody who proposed to take tankers, big tanker ships, and load them up with water from the lakes and send them to Asia. And again, I'm sure people, when they think about diversion, they're thinking about large-scale diversion like that, or this idea that somebody would come along and build a pipeline and try to take the water to arid regions of the United States that would need it and could benefit. Have indeed there been such proposals in the past? I mean, has someone ever really seriously said, come along and said, I want to build a pipeline to take water from the Great Lakes to the Southwest?
There have been proposals. I don't know how serious they are. The Army Corps of Engineers federal agency did study the idea of using Great Lakes water to replenish the Ogallala groundwater aquifer, which underlies a lot of the grain-producing states in the United States and is fast being depleted. And that was back in the early 80s. And they found it was not really cost-effective at that time, although with water prices rising, they might have a different conclusion now. There's also been some kind of grandiose proposals to take water. Actually, one huge proposal that would dam James Bay in Canada, reverse the flow of rivers, shoot it into the Great Lakes, and then from there send the water to the Southwest. But that's such a massive undertaking, I don't think it's realistic. So there have been these ideas or these pipe dreams, literally, and in some cases they've come close to being studied in a rational way, but no one's really actually proposed. Of course, the story that I think most Illinoisans, so to speak, would know is that there is a large, ongoing 108-year-old diversion of water through a canal system from Lake Michigan to the Mississippi River system, the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal. So that's been going on for some time.
Would it if someone did indeed decide it was economically feasible to try to do such a thing, the legislation we've talked about earlier that's working its way through Congress, would that prevent that?
Well, yeah, nominally it would. If the House ratifies the compact and the president signs off on it, Congress has basically then delegated to the states the authority to make these decisions. What I find a little bit problematic in selling this to the public as some kind of final answer is that by the same process that Congress can approve to this compact, it could unconsent and change the law and override it. Now, obviously, there'd be a lot of political pressure not to do that because you've got eight states on board with one scheme, the compact. But, you know, part of the problem that the compact proponents have been pointing to as a reason to get this compact passed by Congress quickly is that we're seeing political power and congressional votes shift from our region, our part of the North America, or part of the United States, to the Southwest.
Mm-hmm. Just, I want to go back. Obviously, we talked a little bit about this, but I'm really interested in talking more about the bottling issue, since that really is the, while people maybe think about the pipeline, it's the bottling issue that maybe is. It's there, it's real, it's there now, and something that I know you've said you're concerned about, and there are other people concerned about it as well, that you could end up diverting as much water that way, and that as far as the compact is concerned, that's allowable because you're not doing it in bulk and you're not doing it in a pipeline, you're doing it one bottle at a time.
Mm-hmm.
How is that regulated, or is there... What sort of regulation is there about whether you can do that? You could set up a bottling plant and take water out of Lake Michigan, for example, and put it in plastic bottles and load it into trucks and send it out to whoever is willing to buy it.
Well, the compact allows states to go beyond the virtual absence of any controls on this if they want to. So far, Michigan and Wisconsin passing legislation for the compact have also created some slightly more stringent review standards for bottled water proposals. But basically, for the most part, if you're an entrepreneur, a water baron who wants to come into the Great Lakes and take the water out, especially from the open lakes, and bottle it, package it, sell it, and ship it, there is no way in which the states could directly stop you under the compact. In fact, it's in my mind, it's sort of sanctioned or encouraged by the compact because of its explicit exemptions.
Certainly, people who at the grassroots level must have, I know they have, organized to try to prevent things like that from happening.
Well, yes. There was a major battle in Wisconsin in the late 90s and early part of this decade to... over the Nestle Corporation, or Perrier at that time, proposal. And the grassroots efforts succeeded in stopping that. Nestle then went to Michigan, where they found a more welcoming state government that has allowed them to start two operations with more planned, totaling, I believe, at last check, about 300 million gallons a year of water, and a lot of that leaving the Great Lakes for good.
Mm-hmm. It gets at this remarkable thirst that we have and our willingness to buy water in plastic bottles. Maybe people don't know it, but there are certainly places where there is commercial bottled water that actually is tap water.
Yeah, I believe about 25% of the market is tap water,
yeah.
Repackaged.
Yeah, and also there's particular cases like this where people are taking surface water and they're also bottling it. I think some people have said at the very least there ought to be some little print on the bottle that says something like, you know, this water came out of Lake Michigan, or this water came out of the municipal water system of X place. So at the very least, people can see where it is the water is coming from, and maybe indeed realize that they're paying money to buy their own tap water.
Yeah, I think consumer education would really help. And I should clarify one thing, that in Michigan, the operations that Nestle is conducting are taking the water basically out of the ground, but it's spring water by its very marketing label, and it's spring water that would then feed Lake Michigan stream. So I think part of the problem is that it stretches the imagination of a lot of people to think of a headwater stream of, say, the Muskegon River in Michigan or any stream in the Great Lakes, having water pulled from it, that somehow has an effect on the lakes themselves. But obviously, it's all one system, and it does ultimately have one effect, and it's one legal precedent.
We have a caller here, someone here in Urbana, where we are, to bring into the conversation. Line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. I was line two. I want to thank you for mentioning the pipeline idea to Texas, because I heard that on BBC because of Canada's involvement about a year and a half ago. Never picked anything up on the U.S. media about it. I don't know. I'm sure you got it from other sources, but I thought I was hallucinating for a while, thinking, what kind of weird idea? I mean, I thought maybe I fabricated the idea. It's so crazy. But, yeah, I was going to, did you discuss the pollutants in the Great Lakes and how if they're, I know Lake Erie was dead for a while, supposedly, but what about all that? I mean, there was the thing in Indiana about a BP petroleum refinery, and Indiana allowed them to have less or more pollution, and then Illinois got upset and Wisconsin got upset. So are they going to coordinate all this stuff later on? Thank you.
Well, there's some good points there, or complex points to talk about. The book Great Lakes for Sale doesn't really deal with pollution issues per se. I previously wrote another book that I won't advertise here about Great Lakes history and future concerns that's broader and does deal with the pollution issues. I think it's fair to say, just in general, that the states continue pretty much to operate independently on pollution standards, doing their own thing. Obviously, there's some federal guidelines under the Clean Water Act that have to be followed, but the states maintain a lot of their autonomy. So it's not unlikely that we're going to see more of these BP-type issues where one state proposes allowing something that other states object to. As far as the issue of the vast North American pipeline, there have been discussions, and I would say some people have characterized them as paranoid fears, although I don't know what they are, really, that the groundwork's being laid for a North American pipeline of oil north and water south. That's at least what some Canadians are worried about.
Hmm. Other questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. Maybe I'll introduce again our guest, David Dempsey. He's Communications Director for Conservation Minnesota. That's a nonprofit organization based in Minneapolis. He also serves on the board of directors of the Alliance for the Great Lakes. He is known for writing about environmental issues in the Great Lakes region. He is the author of the book Great Lakes for Sale, From White Caps to Bottle Caps. It's published by the University of Michigan Press and deals with this issue of diversion of lake water and commercialization of lake water. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Well, since the caller raised the issue of health of the lakes, and maybe that's something that we should at least talk a little bit about, or I can give you
sure.
The opportunity to talk about and talk about water quality issues and how the lakes are doing now.
Well, it's one of those situations that I wish I could simplify to a letter grade or something and let people know we're at a B plus or a D minus, but it's unfortunately more complicated than that. It seems that for every problem we address, we find two that we need to solve. So for example, the literally billions of your taxpayer dollars that we've had to spend on sewage treatment in the last 30 years have paid off in a big way. Our phosphorus pollution and algae blooms, at least for a long time, are way down because of that. And some other controls like phosphorus content limits in laundry detergent and dishwashing detergent. And some of the old toxic chemical threats like PCBs and DDT are way down because we basically banned them, at least in North America. What makes it more complicated, though, is that as population grows and development continues in the region, we're losing a lot of the buffering capacity for the lakes. Wetlands being converted to pavement has a lot of impact in terms of rushing pollutants into the lakes and making them in some cases, unsuitable for swimming and fishing. What we have to do really is get a better handle on the non-industrial sources of Great Lakes pollution. That includes our own use of the land, and that's, I think, going to be the hardest thing to do.
Well, how much of a concern is it that there is still runoff or discharge, either unintentionally or intentionally, from cities around the lakes?
It's a major concern. I cited the billions that we've spent for wastewater and stormwater treatment, but a lot of that investment was made at the start of the modern environmental era in the 70s, so a lot of those systems are starting to age and outlive their usefulness, or at least their ability to handle the now current population. So we're the estimate that the federal and state and federal state officials and advocates put together back in 2005 was that we needed to spend $13 billion more on stormwater and sewage treatment in 5 years to keep pace with what's needed. And that was 3 years ago, so I assume the price tag is higher. And obviously the money has not been rounded up and spent yet.
Yeah, I remember talking a couple of years back with someone actually who was an environmental activist in Canada and talking about the fact that it's a real concern there and that a lot of the Canadian cities that bordered on the lakes had real serious issues with this, with stuff ending up going into the water, and I think indeed a lot of that had to do with the fact that maybe their sewage system or their storm sewer systems were just old and they were not in very good shape and they were easily overwhelmed, and that maybe not intentionally, but sewage and stormwater that included runoff from city streets was ending up in the lakes, and that they would have to make very significant investments in infrastructure improvements to deal with that.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I've been working on these issues for a long time now. Back in the 80s when I was working in Michigan on them, there was sort of a unspoken anger on the U.S. side toward Canadians because the Canadians would criticize the U.S. for being lax on pollution. But a lot of the Canadian municipalities, cities at that time on the Great Lakes were not even treating or were poorly treating their sewage, so they were flushing their toilets into the Great Lakes in many respects. Now, they've come a long way since then, but I think it's fair to say a lot of the larger, older cities on both sides of the border are still grappling with the overflow problem and the problem of stormwater, and it's going to cost billions to fix.
You know, one thing certainly we know is that people like to live near water or like to be able to get near water, and that desire has had significant consequences for coastal environments along the east and west coast of the United States, people wanting to be near the ocean. I'm assuming that some of the same kinds of things have happened around the Great Lakes as there has been more development, building, where people who want to have vacation places or maybe want to live somewhere near or on the lakes. Is that something that has become, that is development around the lakes, has that become a significant issue?
Absolutely. And the very word you use, development, is, I think, part of the issue. People generally in this country, for obvious reasons, have a very positive view of development as being important to the economy. So when people develop sensitive wetlands and shoreline areas in the Great Lakes, as they've been doing for a long time, and particularly in the last couple of decades, it doesn't strike them as a problem, but it can be a huge problem because you're essentially, if you think of wetlands as the kidneys of the Great Lakes, then we're basically wiping those kidneys out and removing the ability of the system to purify itself. So we've got to start thinking in terms of the filtering capacity of these wetlands and other habitats to help keep the lakes clean.
We talked a little bit earlier about the issue that, or about the fact that we may have indeed seen some rebound effect, in terms of the health of lakes and also maybe water level. There has been some concern over recent years about actually dropping water levels in the lake, which may or may not have something to do, which may just be part of a shorter term cycle, or who knows, maybe part of a longer term cycle. Where do things stand now with something as simple and basic as how much water there are in the lakes?
Well, it's remarkable how some of the upper lakes, particularly Lake Superior, have rebounded in the last year. A year ago at this time, Lake Superior hit its record low for August of any year in the last 70 years, or 80 years, actually. And this year it's up, I believe, more than a foot from that level, maybe even further in recent times. I've watched the Great Lakes rise and fall during my career dramatically. I can recall very clearly back in 1985, working for the governor of Michigan, we had to try to find government funds to move people's houses back from the shoreline because they were falling into the lake as the lake rose. And then within 3 years, 1988, we had a situation where the Mississippi was and the Great Lakes were down dramatically. And at that time, the governor of Illinois, Jim Thompson, wanted to increase the flow of the Chicago diversion by three times to 10,000 cubic feet per second and shoot the water down to the Mississippi, and that caused an uproar in the region. But basically what I'm trying to say is within a couple of years we went from near record highs, or actually record highs, to near record lows. So it can fluctuate very quickly. And I think it's important, and I try to do this, although I'm not sure I always succeed, but it's important for environmental advocates not to attribute any particular part of the water cycle that we're at to overuse or climate change. A year ago, a lot of people were speculating that the Great Lakes were way down because of global warming, and this year, obviously, that would be a hard case to make.
Mm-hmm. And that it's just one of those things where we really don't exactly know what's going on. What really, it's no doubt complicated and a part of a big dynamic system, and to pin that on one sort of cause, even as big as global climate change would be, apparently you can't really do that.
You can, and I think that raises one of the most important questions that we really have not addressed about the Great Lakes, is that what we know about them is still a lot less than what we don't know about them. And I just wish that the states and provinces, and in fact some of the universities and local governments in the region, were pooling their resources to do a lot more work in terms of basic science to understand where the water is coming from, where it's going, and how pollutants are getting into it, and what their effects are. But we talk a lot about our love of the Great Lakes here in this part of North America, but we don't always put the money into the studies to really understand how they work.
Well, that seems kind of surprising, given that it's such a significant feature, both in terms of the environment and economically, and certainly the states that surround it have major resource research universities who would be capable of doing that work. You'd think that there wouldn't be any shortage of interest in doing that very kind of thing.
I don't think there's a shortage of interest. I think there's a shortage of money. There's a lot of great research institutions, including a lot of the Big Ten institutions in the Great Lakes region, that are doing pieces of this and parts of this, but no one's really made this overall large funding commitment that I think we need. Even if we can't agree on what the new laws or regulations or standards ought to be, it seems like we ought to be able to agree on the research agenda and get it funded, but we haven't been able to do that.
Let's talk with somebody else here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello. What is your opinion? I came in late, so you may have covered this, but what is your opinion of the ethanol effect, in which the ethanol plants use over 1 million gallons of water a day? And then I'll ask the second question if I can.
Well, in answer to that question, what my overall concern is that corn-based ethanol and the processes that consume all that water to manufacture it are not sustainable. The cliche, I guess, is that this is a transitional fuel, and that in a few years we'll switch to perennial-based or prairie grass-based, for example.
Hopefully,
ethanol.
Really.
But I am not a big proponent of more ethanol plants in the Great Lakes Basin, because I think that they will significantly lower water levels. A lot of that water will evaporate and not come back.
And several of them are scheduled to come online.
Right. I don't think it's been thought out very well.
And what's your opinion of the projection that by 2050 we will add 140 million people to up to a 440 to 450 million people in the United States?
Well, my attitude is that it's going to become more and more difficult to resist the political pressure to, quote, share, unquote, the Great Lakes, because a lot of those new, a disproportionate number of those new bodies are going to be outside the Great Lakes region where there's not much water. So in that sense, this compact makes has a lot of logic behind it in trying to create a system that we can defend in the future. But as I said, I think there are some loopholes that need to be closed, too.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Just to go back to something that we were talking about a little bit before, your comment was something like what we, in terms of our scientific understanding of the lakes and how they work, what we don't know far outweighs what we do know, and that your argument was that there was really significant need for a lot more research to get a better understanding of the lake. So are there some particular things, some particular questions about the lakes, how they function, particular problems that leap to mind right away where you would say, well, here is something that we really, where our knowledge is just not what it should be?
Well, I think so. I mean, I'm constantly surprised by how surprised the experts are about the Great Lakes water levels, for example. A year ago, no one was really predicting this kind of a rebound, and we were shocked previous to that by how low they fell. I think a basic water budget for the Great Lakes, although it would be very difficult to come up with, where the water comes from, in the ground, in the surface, where it goes, how much evaporates, how climate affects that, and so forth, is something we really need to have for such a major share of the world's fresh water, but we are far away from that. There are studies done by federal and agencies and universities that get at pieces of that, but you know, it surprises some people to find out how much of the volume of the Great Lakes comes from groundwater. A lot of the water that enters the lakes begins in aquifers and ultimately reaches the Great Lakes either through discharge to streams or directly through the shorelines of the Great Lakes. And that's, I think, a basic fact a lot of people don't understand. So we've got a long way to go there. And I guess the more sensitive area of research in terms of its implications, and I'm cautious about this, but we really need to understand better how much water can be withdrawn from both particular watersheds of the Great Lakes and the Great Lakes as a whole before severe or any ecological impacts result. What I'm worried about in opening that door is that you then create, I guess, what people would call the tolerable destruction of the Great Lakes by defining what is you can take without killing off a fish population. But still, it's knowledge we need to have to understand what we can allow and what we can't.
Yeah. We have several callers here. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, very quickly, let me introduce the guest, Dave Dempsey. He is the Communications Director for Conservation Minnesota. It's a nonprofit organization based in Minneapolis. He also serves on the board of directors of the Alliance for the Great Lakes and is well known for writing about environmental issues in the Great Lakes region, including the issue of diversion of Great Lakes water. And that is the subject of a recent book that he's authored. The title is Great Lakes for Sale from White Caps to Bottle Caps. It's published by the University of Michigan Press. And we'll go on here to talk next again with some local folks here. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, you know, what the mechanics would be. It looks like, you know, when you see the problems in the West and the Southwest, that water is a valuable resource. And it seems like the logical thing to say is, if you take any out, you pay. And you pay according to what you take out. And then if you put something in it, you pay too, because that means that you're polluting the river. And, you know, with so many states and Canada having so many provinces that border on it, is there, what would be the mechanics, you know, of would a commission like this would be able to do that, to say, okay, if you take some out, you charge? And locally, like the Andersons ethanol plant, if you have the money to drill the well, you can take out as much as you want. And the more you take out, the cheaper it is. And that seems very wrong to me. So in the Great Lakes, I'm wondering, how could you get a commission that could regulate the whole five lakes and start charging people? And I'll hang up and listen.
Well, I think the caller has a really important point to make, although I'm not sure I agree with her solution, but we don't attribute any economic value to water as a society, and at least public value. Obviously, there are companies that are bottling it that are getting a great private value. And I think it makes sense to charge users, especially large users, based on volume of use, and put that money into some kind of a fund, in this case, to protect the Great Lakes. I'm not in favor of allowing Arizona to pay billions to us to take water out and not return it, because I think that has a danger to the health of the Great Lakes. But certainly in-basin users should be paying for their use to some extent to help maintain the system. I would make one exception to that, which is that I don't think domestic users, people who need the water simply to survive for their drinking water purposes and other typical uses, should have to pay beyond, you know, for their rather small-scale uses. But the question was, you know, what could we do to get a commission together to do something like that? Well, we've got, you know, literally multiple commissions in the Great Lakes already. We have a U.S.-Canadian commission called the International Joint Commission. We have the Great Lakes Commission, which is among the eight Great Lakes states. We now have this new water regional water body that's been created by the new compact. One of those institutions could, in theory, be charged with doing what the caller says, and I think I'd prefer that to creating any more Great Lakes commissions. But so far, there hasn't been any real discussion of that.
All right. Hopefully that gets to the question of the caller. Here's someone else, also in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hi. I was concerned with the Futurgen plant that they're planning around here in Illinois, down around Mattoon. And I was wondering, what's your opinion on the pollutants going down into the Earth's surface, down in the bottom, and how that would affect the water systems? And what's your opinion on that? Thank you.
I don't know if that's something that you feel you can comment. This the I don't know if you know what it is the person is talking about. Essentially, we're talking about carbon sequestration.
Oh.
And the idea was that there was this proposal to build a plant that would it was coal gasification, and then would the byproduct, the carbon dioxide, instead of being released into the atmosphere, would be injected down into the ground. And there are some, I guess, some people have real questions about, you know, again, potential environmental impact of, you know, of doing that.
Well, I'm not a big fan of coal or carbon sequestration or coal gasification, but I can't really comment on this plant. But what I would say is that my experience in dealing with groundwater contamination and groundwater flow issues for now 25 years is that although we've come some ways in our understanding of groundwater geology, we really don't have, I don't think, a handle on it. And I have been very alarmed during my career to see unexpected consequences of what were thought to be benign actions of, you know, discharging supposedly clean water to the ground and or other contaminants, and thinking they would be treated, and ultimately having them come back and cost the public a lot of money to clean up. So I guess caution would be the word for that.
We're coming to the point here. We have maybe 2 or 3 minutes left. I guess, you know, one of the things that I find myself coming back to is the idea that the principle that governs the use of water is very, very old. The riparian idea that says that if you, and I sort of mentioned it before, if you have land on top of an aquifer, you can drill a well and draw water, and if you have a stream flowing by your property, you can take water out of that. And the key issue is that it's supposed to be reasonable use, and then the question is, well, okay, who gets to decide what's reasonable use? And I wonder whether, in fact, that this principle has been part of the way that we think about resource use for such a long time, whether we're ever going to. And maybe you would argue whether we should or not, but one would ask whether we're actually ever going to be able to get away from that, or is that likely ever to change?
I think it is changing, and I think it's changing because we're running up against some limits of what our hydrology can take. Basically, there's so many people globally and so many now in the Great Lakes region and a relatively finite amount of water. So we're going to have to come up with a new approach. What I would argue for is sort of a hybrid, where we take the reasonable use principle and maintain it for people's domestic purposes, as I said before, drinking water and other household uses and some industrial uses. But we should not basically open up the Great Lakes to wholesale use for people outside the basin. The principle of the riparian doctrine is that if you live in a watershed, to presume most of the water that you use will go back to it. But that's not the case when you're taking it, putting it in packages, and sending it to Missouri or Texas. So I think we have to start thinking in terms of limits and in terms of in watershed versus out of watershed users.
Well, again, I guess that again brings us back around to the one of the concerns that people have about the compact, and that is this there's a hole in it, and that's the issue that doesn't really get dealt with. And you've said that you have some concerns. I am sure that there are a lot of other people who have concerns too. And maybe the compact as it exists is, you would argue that that's a good thing, and that that's a good first step, and we need to do that. And so you're going to say, okay, we think it's a good thing if the Congress approves that and the president signs it. But then that there are some other issues that still need to be addressed, and this is one of them. What's the likelihood, do you think, that it will be?
Well, my hope right now, and it's a long shot, is that a couple of members of the House from the Great Lakes region, including Bart Stupak, who's from Upper Michigan, will be able to work some language into the congressional consent resolution for this compact that makes it clear, at least, that Congress is not condoning or facilitating commercialization of Great Lakes water. And I guess I just want to state real concisely if I can what the threat is. The threat is not so much that any particular bottling operation is going to draw the Great Lakes down, or even that 100 of them will, but that the very idea of the water of the Great Lakes as a product could lead to a loss of public control. In other words, what's the basis for the Great Lakes states saying that we're going to manage pipelines and vessels, but we're not going to manage commercial bottling? Once you make that distinction, you basically are opening up the possibility of others saying that there's not a science basis for this, and the Great Lakes ought to be open for any private uses that people want to make of them. And I think there's going to be lawsuits, legal actions brought to do that in the next 10 or 20 years.
So even though it's at least that specific about what kind of use you're going to allow, that you think it's that somebody is going to come along and say, well, wait a minute. Well, what's the problem with the pipeline? I mean, why should we say you could bottle an equivalent amount of water and ship that out in trucks, but you're saying to me, well, I can't do that with the pipeline? That really, what exactly is the difference?
That's exactly what I'm worried about. I think this compact sets up a dual standard that is going to be very vulnerable to attack in the courts, instead of being a consistent standard where we limit large-scale removals for whatever purpose.
And can the people over on the House side, can they just put something in the legislation that doesn't, that's not going to require it the Senate to reconsider? That's just sort of an addendum that they're going to tack on that says, here we have these concerns?
They could, through various means, enter things in the congressional record and not have it go back to the House or the Senate. But to make it really meaningful, it would have to be a change in the consent resolution that the Senate would then have to agree to. And as I said, it's a long shot because there's so much momentum for this compact right now that, frankly, some people think people like me are spoiling the party and delaying the celebration, and we should just get out of the way.
Yeah. Well, so overall here in the long run, what you think, yes, there have been some positive developments, but there are still real concerns.
There are. And I think the positive part is the states are now working together as they never have on the Great Lakes. I just think they've managed to caulk the bottom of the bathtub while they're leaving the drain open and the water's going to go out a different direction.
Our guest for this part of Focus 580, Dave Dempsey. He is Communications Director for Conservation Minnesota. That is a nonprofit organization based in Minneapolis. He also serves on the board of directors of the Alliance for the Great Lakes and is well known for writing about environmental issues in the Great Lakes region, including this issue of diversion that we've talked about. And if you'd like to read more on that subject, you look for his book, Great Lakes for Sale, From White Caps to Bottle Caps, published by University of Michigan Press. And Mr. Dempsey, thanks very much.
Thank you, David. I appreciate it.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future environment. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910. A reminder that tomorrow morning on the program, in the first part of the show, we'll be talking about current events in Georgia, and our guest for the show will be Richard Tempest. He is Associate Professor of Slavic Languages and Literature and also Director of the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center at the University of Illinois. He'll be joining us for hour number one of the show. And then in the second part of the program, we'll be talking about the Gulf of Mexico's dead zone, something that has appeared now in the Gulf for many years, and this year's has been almost the worst, not the worst ever, but close to the worst ever. And there is concern that these kind of dead zones also appear various places around the world near cities. And we'll be talking with Nancy Rabelais. She is executive director and professor of the Louisiana University's Marine Consortium. And we'll be talking about that issue with her tomorrow morning in hour number two. We're here weekday mornings, 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. We always welcome your questions and comments. And we always hope that at this point that you'll stay tuned, because there's much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. And the host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. We'll get underway at noon with news from National Public Radio, the BBC, and AM 580. Then today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll talk about the history of school lunches in America. Historian Susan Levine will be our guest. She is the author, most recently, of School Lunch Politics, The Surprising History of America's favorite welfare program. We'll talk with her following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at commodity prices in Kansas City. September wheat, that contract is trading at 941, up 35. December 962, up 34 and three quarters. In Chicago, September wheat 907, up 32 and a quarter. December 930 and a half, up 31. September corn 594 and a half, up 19 and a quarter. December 614, up 19. March 633, up 19. May 644 and a half, up 18 and a half. September soybeans 1335 and a half, up 41 and three quarters. November 1344, up 44. January 1365, up 47 and three quarters. March 1376 and a half, up 46. September meal 360 even, up 710. September oil 5537, up 230. At the market in Chicago, August live cattle 101.25, up 55.